And so all of the things that I did, definitely the early projects were definitely my best. And the whole leadership thing was really, really interesting to me because I'd worked for some people that I just didn't like. And I didn't like them because it's personality clash or whatever, but also didn't like it because they didn't set work in the way that I wanted to. And I had a great boss who I watched, and I used to write things down. I still do this now, write things down that I see that I like and think, okay, how can I do that? You know, particularly when I watching people speak or hearing people talk about culture. And so the biggest thing that I learned was definitely early on in my career is by watching people and their interactions with others and finding out what's effective. And that's how I learned to communicate in different ways. So that it's, again, early on in my project management career, but still one of the things that I learned was how do I change my style depending on the person that I'm talking to?
Hi, and welcome to the Sunday Lunch Project Manager podcast for Sunday, the 24th of March, 2024. This is your host, Nigel Creaser, and today I've got a rerun of my interview with Colin D. Ellis, the Getting Shit Done guy. Hi, it's Nigel again. If you are listening to this, that means that you are listening to the old style of the podcast. You may like the old style of having it split into two pieces, but I know some of my listeners didn't. So what I've done, I have created the option for you to be able to listen to everything all in one go. You don't have to wait till next week. You could get it now. At the moment, it's just on Spotify. We'll be coming on Patreon as well. Costs you, £3 plus the VAT, I think it is, over a month. And that means you get the whole thing all in one go. So the other advantage, that'll be coming out on a Sunday. This one, you will notice, have just come out Monday. Wouldn't make a big difference, really, but there you go. You've got it. You've got that choice. Helps me invest in better equipment and maybe a few other bonus items going forward. So if you can spare, essentially, a cup of coffee once a month, and you get the benefit of getting it earlier and getting it all together. So pop along to Spotify. Have a look in there where it is, and there'll be a little lock sign against one called number 132/133, John Henney, the voice coach. And that's the combined one, and you should be able to click on there, do what Spotify tells you to do to register and put all your payments in. Yeah, that's it. And the only thing, if you have done that and you do it, I don't know if I get details on it yet. It's very new. So send me ping me a message through whatever medium you can get hold of me, and you'll get a mention on the show. So again, thanks very much, and let you carry on with the show. Cheers now. So I have a number of sponsors, affiliate links, in the way that it's set up, that have kindly allowed me to share their services, really. The first one is Mike Kling, and Mike runs PM online PM courses, and it is a great resource for getting those fundamentals of project management trained, reasonably priced, and Mike presents it in an accessible and clear manner. You can check out some of his videos on his YouTube channel and kind of give you a view of where they are. But the code for that, if you go to nigelcreaser.com/onlinepmcourses, all one word, lowercase, that'll redirect you to it. There's varying different levels that you can buy. You can buy individual courses, you can buy pathways as well, if you like. And I get a kickback off those. Mike kindly shares me that. So if you do jump on and use it, I hope you find it really useful. I think he has money back guarantees and things like that as well. So there's a very limited risk on that. So jump on that. And that, again, it's nigelcreaser.com/onlinepm. courses, and enjoy. So before we jump into the interview with Colin, I'm doing another rerun. An apology first. Last week, you got nothing in your stream. Some of you might have noticed, some of you may not have done. I have had a few technical challenges with recording episodes, and I've got a little bit just in time at the moment with the interviews. And so two failed interviews have put me right on the back foot. I am looking to resurrect this, get some more interviews in the bag. But hopefully I'll resolve it. In the meantime, you might get a few episodes where they are reruns. They're brilliant anyway, people who have been on the show from way back. So if you've heard them before, I'm sure that when you do go through this, you'll remind yourself some stuff. And there'll be some stuff you didn't hear the first time. And for people who haven't listened to some of the earlier guests, it's a bit of a way for you to hear some of them, and you can jump back and start from episode one at some point. So I'll let you get on with it. Again, apologies, and I'll look to resolve as soon as I can. Look after yourself. Bye.
Right, so today I'd like to welcome to the Sunday Lunch Project podcast, Colin D. Ellis. Colin is a author, a public speaker, a project manager, a man with many irons in many fires, experience working in places such as the Shop Direct, Ministry of Education, Ministry of Justice in New Zealand, and Trinity Group. Founder of a number of organizations, including the Getting Shit Done Club. Hopefully that doesn't get me an explicit tag for the podcast. The Whiskey Trip, and is an award-winning speaker and culture change specialist at the moment. So welcome to the podcast, Colin.
Cheers, Nigel. Thank you.
It's great to have you on. As I start with all of my interviews, and I think some people will pick up the answer to this before I've even asked the question, but where were you born and where did you hail from?
So I was born in a place called Whiston, which is about 8 miles east of Liverpool. So every time I'm on stage, I always tell people, you know, particularly when I'm not in England, which isn't very often these days, I say I'm from Liverpool. And then every now and again, you'll get a Scouser in the audience going, "You're not from Liverpool, mate. You don't talk like us." But Whiston was where I was born. I lived pretty much all of my life in a little village called Rainhill, which is famous for trains, which you'll probably know, which one person knew once. I said that on stage, like, "Oh, it's famous for trains. It's the birthplace of passenger railways." And this guy came up to me at the end, and like, I think this was in Australia or maybe even New Zealand. He was like, "Oh yes, yeah, so I know all about passenger railways." I was like, "Oh my God, what have I got myself into here?"
You just knew the history. It's funny how the big world is a very small world, isn't it?
It is. The first when I emigrated, sorry to interrupt, when I emigrated to Australia, I didn't know anybody, didn't know a single person here. And so I went to a networking event and I was sat next to a guy and I got talking to him and he was a Scouser. And I said, "Mate," I was like, where are you from?" He's like, "I was born in Whiston." I was like, "Are you kidding me? I've come all the way to Australia. I'm sat next to someone from the same hospital as me." And we worked out that we were born 3 weeks apart as well.
Jeez, so you were probably at the same school and stuff as well.
Yeah.
So you say you emigrate. Where are you now then? Where are you living?
So Australia. I'm in Melbourne, Australia. I emigrated to, we emigrated to New Zealand in 2007. I was working for Littlewood's Shop Direct Group. I had a job that I loved. I loved it. But we just had a little boy and didn't necessarily want to bring him up in England, if the truth be told. Mm-hmm. And I randomly flew to New Zealand to see if I could get a job and got offered three jobs.
Oh, wow.
All heads of project departments in New Zealand. So I figured that would be the time to go, given that we are, and you know, that was just before the global financial crisis and the door shut once and for all on kind of immigration in the way that it worked back then.
Yeah. So what made you choose New Zealand? Or was it just a throw a dart at a board?
It was the easiest place to get a visa for.
That's the honest answer. We looked at Canada. That seemed to be a lengthy process. We didn't want to move to Australia because, you know, as you're told in school in England, it's the capital of poisonous, bitey things.
Yeah.
Where everything just wants to kill you. You know, there's a cat looking at me weird through the window now. And so New Zealand seemed to be an easier route. And I've got a cousin who lives there, and we'd met her at a wake back in Liverpool, and she was talking about how great New Zealand was and how we should come and live in New Zealand. So we looked into it, and it seemed to be, you know, I had the job that I was doing at the time was on the skills shortages list. So IT project management was on the skills short, which seems incredible now. And so
I think it's still at
Yeah,
I have a colleague who's just gone across there literally in the last few weeks, and I think she was saying that there's still a skill shortage in that in New Zealand now.
Well, it's an obvious thing to say, Nigel, but you only feel it when you get there. Like, it's so far away. Mm. Like, I just came back from the US, and it took me 23 hours and 50 minutes journey time to get home from the mid-year, not even the center of America, but like the mid-north, so kind of inland northwest. And you realize just how far away it is. I mean, it's beautiful, it's safe, it's clean. It's, you know, there was a joke that said, welcome to New Zealand, please turn your clocks back 20 years. And it is, it's a lovely, lovely part of the world, but it is a long way away.
Yeah, it's about as far as I can get from here, isn't it? Yeah. So you yeah. You mentioned you had a little one and family. So tell me about your family.
Yes, it's two kids. It's my wife and two kids. So I met my wife when I was working for the Mirror Group. Good old Trinity Mirror. I think they've changed their name these days. Now they're something a bit more jazzy, a bit more consultancy name now. she was working on the corporate newspaper, and I was head of projects for the Mirror Group. So we're both based in Canary Wharf for a while there. So that's where we met. And yeah, I got two kids. And they, you know, my son was born in England. So he was one when we left. My daughter was born 5 months after we arrived in New Zealand. So that was a culture shock, all right? Yeah. So yeah, they've moved about a bit as well. So we're ready for a bit of stability. So Melbourne's home for the foreseeable future. Plus the fact you get a 5 month summer. So why would I leave it?
Yeah, that's a fair point. Yeah. So you decided to do not many massive life change things pretty much all around the same time.
Yeah. So 2007. So I resigned a job, quit a job, sold a house, bought a house, got married, had a baby, and emigrated all at the same time to a place where we didn't know anybody. So yeah, that's we've taken a few risks, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah.
And I always kept my risk template up to date.
I love to see that risk meeting. Doing that. Having tried to apply some of the just some simple Kanban boards in my house, it's not really worked that well. When you try to bring the tooling back home, it takes a little while for it to sink in, I find.
We had some success, actually, with Kanban boards, and yet one morning I woke up and the thing was screwed up on the floor. I'm like, okay, there's the message. Maybe the project manager's becoming a dictator.
Yeah, I know what you mean. So you said you, obviously, you're born in Whiston. Did you stay and grow up in that area?
Yeah, did. Yeah, did very much. I was late to leave home because I had a too good at home, Nigel. So I stayed there, you know, pretty much until I was 23. And then even when I moved out, I moved into the same area. It was, it was a nice area of Liverpool. There was no real need. It was easy to get into the city to go and watch Everton and go out on the tiles, and it was easy to get it into places like Warrington where we'd do likewise on the beers. So yeah,
Mr. Smith's,
right until it burnt down. Yeah, that was my first suit I bought for work. And I remember going to Mr. Smith's in it. My mates still give me grief for the fact that I fell asleep in the toilets one night. It's like still getting grief for that, like, you know, 30 years later. It's insane.
Yeah.
So good old Mr. Smith's, yeah.
I had some friends and people I worked with who were Warrington Way, and I'd heard of the rumours of the history of Mr. Smith's a little bit.
It was The Hitman and Her. There was a TV show called The Hitman and Her, and they used to record it there. Yeah,
I remember that as well. So when you were growing up in Whiston and living a lap of luxury with home, what was it you wanted to be?
Did you want to be a project manager?
Well, yeah. So Rainhill was where I grew up, Nigel, and no one grows up wanting to be a project manager. I wanted to be an architect. I did technical drawing for a year. I grew up wanting to play for Everton. Right, that's the standard Liverpool thing. No one wants to play for Liverpool because no one in Liverpool supports Liverpool. People from Scandinavia support Liverpool and Australia. So I wanted to play for Everton, and then I was a decent player actually. But then I quit because I was just playing. I was playing 6 days a week. And then I wanted to be an architect, and I did technical drawing for a year. I was rubbish, like properly terrible at it. And then I had no idea. I literally had no idea. I just knew I didn't want to stay in school. I mean, going to university wasn't the thing back in the late 80s. It wasn't the thing that everybody did. And so, you know, I got, you know, the third time I was suspended from school, I had a bit of a checkered school history, truth be told. My dad helped me write a letter to NatWest Bank asking them, probably pleading with them, can I have a job, please? And I did one interview in Warrington just to check I wasn't a serial killer. Then I had a second interview in St. Helens to check that I'd fit into the culture, but it's St. Helens and it would be easy to fit into that culture. And that was it. And I got a job at 17, just writing a speculative letter. I can't imagine that happening these days.
No, it would be, it's a different way of getting roles, isn't it? I think.
Yeah.
Very much.
No, so many people for each role now, of course.
Yeah. Yeah. That's probably, yeah, you're true. Cause it's, I'm guessing in those sort of roles, it would have been similar to me. People weren't traveling when you're pooling on those very much a local areas. The people wouldn't be traveling significant distances to get to those kind of roles.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Definitely not my role, but bank clerk sat on the front counter serving people. No one's traveling for that.
Do you know what? I did bank clerk as part of my what's it called, work experience. I had a week working in the TSB in Oswestry where I grew up, and I really enjoyed the when you take all the money in the back room and you count it on the machines and they do the counting and the franking of the checks. I actually quite enjoyed that. I found it quite therapeutic, but I don't think I could have stuck it for very long.
Well, I remember I kind of got promoted to the machine room early, you know, kind of when I was nearly 18, I think. And the machines were these huge, long things. They must have been about 10 feet long. And they made the most incredible noise. And I remember the bank manager, Mr. Oakes, his name was. He came around. He always used to walk around with his cigar. That's the way they used to do things. Mm-hmm. He was like, Ellis, what the devil is this thing? I was like, oh, it sorts the check. It franks the checks, Mr. Oakes, and it sorts them. He's like, it's a bloody future. It's the future, this stuff. Yeah, he was right. Who knew?
But the funny thing is, you're saying that it's about 10 foot long. The one I had, I think it was the size of a printer that was there. So you can tell the difference in the size of branch that you were in compared to what I was probably. So you talk about the bank. Obviously, you got into project management and you were doing banking. How long was that for?
I did banking for 7 years. And you know what I love, Nigel, and you know, I said school really wasn't my thing. It just wasn't. And then all of a sudden, I was in an industry where I was in front of people every day and I was part of teams. And that's the first time, except playing football, that's the first time I'd really been exposed to that, where people were giving thought about how to create teams. And I really enjoyed working in the banking. I didn't really enjoy where I was working. You know, I wanted to be in the city. I wanted to work in Liverpool. So much to the horror of my parents, I got a job working in sales for the Liverpool Echo, which is the local paper. Now, in those days, you could get a 0% mortgage if you were staff at the bank. My mum and dad were like, why would you leave a bank? It's got a non-contributory pension, 0% mortgage. It was like, I want to work in the city and just go out straight out on the beers after work. You know, that was my rationale at the time. And I, you know, telesales, people always say, did you enjoy the role? And I did, because the team camaraderie was great. But the one thing I learned was how to touch type. So they sent you on a 3-day course in Matthew Street in Liverpool. And I learned how to touch type, which I still do to this day, which is the best thing that I got out of it. But I loved the team. I loved the team that I was part of. I loved the camaraderie. I loved the pressure of trying to hit targets. I wasn't very good. You know, honestly, I wasn't very good. But I loved that pressure. And in 97, they put the call out because NatWest wasn't year 2000 compliant. Not that I was much of a techie, but they put the call out for project managers. And I went and saw this guy who was, there was one project manager in the entire organization. I went to see him and he seemed like a pretty nice guy. And he said that he enjoyed it. But I still didn't think that I wanted to do it. And then someone approached me and said, listen, we want to talk to you about this year 2000 thing. And they said, oh, we really think you'd be a good project manager. I was like, okay. I was like, can you just explain to me what is a project manager? And I still remember this. He said, you get a car, you get a phone, and you'll be away from home on and off for 4 years. I was like, I definitely want to be a project manager. That's how it was sold to me. But he said, I said, why me? And he said, oh, principally because you're good with people and you're good with teams. And he said, that's, you know, it was none of the Prince 2 stuff, none of the can you do a WBS? It was none of that. It was good with people, good with teams. And that was early 1997. And that changed everything.
So that was that with the Trinity group that you said?
Yeah, it was Trinity PLC to begin with. And then towards the end of that, we merged with the Mirror and became Trinity Mirror. But it was Trinity Group to begin with. So that was regional newspapers. So Huddersfield Examiner, Newcastle Chronicle and Journal, right. Belfast Telegraph, which I loved working there, cut down in Cardiff, Western Mail and Echo, Liverpool Echo. Middlesbrough, what's the one? There was one in Middlesbrough.
So the Liverpool Echo was part of that group, was it?
Was part of that group, yeah. So we had to replace systems in all of those areas. And I think there was like three project managers to cover all of it.
Jeez, a busy time then.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, and I literally was home Saturday, Sunday, and then gone again and fly into glamorous places like, you know, Middlesbrough and... I used to drive to Middlesbrough. I used to fly to Belfast, but drive to Middlesbrough.
Yeah, I've done Newcastle a few times from me down here in Shropshire. Mm. And I quite enjoy that drive up the A1M road because it's always sunny when I drive up there for some reason. But yeah, maybe that's just lucking out.
So I used to go M6 and then A66, and the A66 was always covered in snow in the winter. Mm. So you couldn't go that way and you had to find a different route. So happy days.
Yeah, right. So that kind of takes us on to sort of like how and why PMing. So it was when you moved into that PMing role, what were you thinking there as they said, well, we think you can do PM? Because from what you were saying there, the person asking you to do that obviously understood what a PM really was about. It wasn't someone who was just going, we need a PM, they need a Gantt chart tool. Because like you say, the teams and the people relationship side of it being the primary driver. What did you do to prep yourself for that?
You know, that's a really good question, Nigel. I reflected on it recently when I spoke at a conference, when somebody asked me a question. They asked me something like, did you know how to plan when you started? And it was a great question because I hadn't really thought of it. And I said, well, no, I didn't. I literally didn't know a thing. And so what was I thinking? Well, I was thinking, firstly, it sounded a bit glamorous because I was doing a lot of travel. But it sounded like a skill set that I really wanted to develop. You know, the other things that I was doing, you know, there were skills, but there was nothing really that I felt really passionately about. Then all of a sudden I was in this role where I was asked to be a role model. I don't think we used those words back then, but I was asked to be a bit of a role model for what we were trying to do. And I could let my personality shine a little bit. You know, I'm a high extrovert, and I think they wanted to see a little bit of that, but at the same time wanted to make sure that I was capturing the detail. And in the early days, I just wasn't capturing the detail. I didn't know how to do a schedule. I didn't know how to, you know, kind of manage risk. And so I had a really good boss, and he laid things on the line to me a couple of times. You know, I remember once he said, you know, where's your plan? And I tapped my head. I'm like, it's all up here, Rob. And he was like, wait, what? He's like, you need to get it out of there and onto a piece of paper. And so he was fabulous. He was instrumental in really helping me. And I think, you know, I was 27 then, 27 or 28. And he really put the emphasis on me doing the things that I was uncomfortable doing within my personality. You know, a lot of what I talk about, especially to project managers these days, is we very much focus on our own personality, our own communication style. were to be successful is it's doing all of the stuff that your personality doesn't want to do. You know, I remember bounding. I had a team of developers and infrastructure engineers and worked with a bunch of people. I remember bounding in the all extroversion, literally kind of the room just clammed up and no one wanted a bar of it. And so, you know, I knew very early on that I had a challenge. You know, I had to work really, really hard to learn techniques. And we did a little Prince. We did Prince 2. We were like real early adopters. We did it, I think it was in 98. And I failed the foundation exam. I must be the only person in history to fail the foundation exam. They make it that easy. Because I tried to apply it practically, which sounds like a terrible thing to say. But when I answered the questions, I'm like, oh, right, in real life, what would I do? And I very, you know, quickly found out, well, the theory doesn't always match the reality of the situations that you find yourself in. So that's a long answer to a short question. But, you know, what was I thinking? I was thinking there's a real opportunity for me to stretch myself and develop a career into something that, you know, because I love the variety, is something that I can see myself doing long term.
Yeah, because I think that just as you said, the PM, the variety point there, and I know that's been an attraction for me for project management, is that the variety of what you're trying to do is quite often good, the variety of people is often good, but sometimes the repetitive nature of some of it can be the downside of it, isn't it? Is that you know what's going to happen with the project, and that on the face of it, looking in, it looks like you're going to get lots of variety, but it's a lot of variety of the same thing, if you know what I mean.
It is, Nigel. That's a really good point. But it's, you know, it's really what you create it. You know, I often poke fun at the project managers who say, oh, I don't like the administration side of it. You know, I don't like writing reports. I don't like updating my schedule. I'm like, look, every job's got its bits of it that are more mundane than the rest. And if you don't like writing reports, go and be a BA. I still don't know what those guys do. go and be a BA. But you know, you've got to accept that there, you know, with every job, there's a little bit of it that you won't prefer doing, but you've still got to do that really, really well, because it's part of what we do. If you don't like maintaining a schedule, don't be a project manager. You know, and one of the things that I did later on in my career, and I developed a bit of a name for myself for doing this, is what I used to meet with lots of my peers, particularly in New Zealand. And they would be like, oh, how'd you get people to get their reports in on time? I'm like, well, if they don't get the report in on time, then they get performance managed. How do you do it? He's like, what do you mean performance managed? I'm like, well, it's their job to get their, if they can't get a report in on time, what chance do you think they've got of getting a project in on time? And it's kind of those little things, those little disciplines that I definitely developed early on, and kind of, I guess, reassured myself that was the trade-off for all of the other variety stuff, is with the traveling, with the different people, with the different issues. You know, and I loved planning. I loved planning so much. I loved trying to get as much certainty as possible, because I knew that as soon as you get into delivery, it's easy for me. And yet that's a skill that we seem to be losing within the profession these days, you know, and I poke fun at sponsors all the time because I think they're to blame, you know, these Nike project sponsors, just do it, just do it, just do it. Yeah. And you never get time to plan anymore. And the way that they're trying to circumvent that now is by going agile. That's a whole other thing.
Yeah. That's I know what you're saying. It's that kind of thing of, great, we don't have to be sure on what we want. And you do need to be sure on what you want. It's just a different way of getting to that, being sure on what you want.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think some people see agile as we can change our minds.
And permission to change our mind.
Yeah, yeah. Having recently been on a product owner course from the Scrum stuff, and kind of it's dropped into my mind how that product owner role within an organization, being given the right level of authority and the right level of power to own that product, is fundamental to making an agile project work. Because without that, you might as well just randomly pick what you're doing.
Well, that's right. And, you know, it's only suitable for certain things. And yeah. we've still got organizations who are like, all right, everything's agile now. It's like, it's going to fail. You're going to fail.
Yeah, but, you don't you know, use a hammer like, to screw something in or paint a wall, do you?
Yeah, that's so right.
Make sure you're using the right tool.
We've got the cycle. We're in the cycle of waterfall bad, agile good. Mm. I'm like, some of the best projects I've ever been involved in were waterfall projects. The difference was we had competent people who knew how to do it in the right way, you know?
Yeah, I know what you mean. So talking of your projects, and so you mentioned your year 2000 projects that your first projects you jumped into. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so, you know, I was doing pretty much three projects at once, and that really, I really enjoyed that. Not only that, I used that model as I headed up my own project departments moving forward. So I was managing one in initiation, one in delivery, one in closure. And so, you know, I would spend a week, you know, one day, the implementation, I was 3 days on one site. I remember my favorite one was Huddersfield. So I was working at the Huddersfield Examiner. They didn't have an office for me. I was working for regionals. So there's a bit of a kind of sideways look at these people coming in from regionals, you know, especially me with my suit on. And so they didn't have it anywhere for me. So they hired a porter cabin and put it in the car park. So I was in a porter cabin. Me and Sue Ibbotson, if you're listening, Sue. Me and Sue Ibbotson were in a porter cabin in a car park. And it was such great fun. I used to have a squirrel that used to come and visit. And I used to feed it. It's no wonder I went nuts.
Very good.
And so, you know, we had so many different stories, but it was a great, lesson for me because the stakeholders were quite different. You know, I remember the sponsor in Teesside in Middlesbrough was quite a hard ass. You know, he was a tough guy to get along with, but I found a way to do it. You know, I worked really hard at that. Much, much easier in Belfast. Lovely, lovely people in Belfast, welcoming, accommodating, would do anything. And so what we had to do very quickly, Nigel, was establish a team and then also communicate really, really well. Because what we were implementing, of course, for those people that remember Y2K, is we weren't implementing just a fix. We were implementing a whole new way of doing things. You know, and I see people now doing new ways of working. I'm like, well, you don't need new ways of working. What you need to do is work with the teams to get new ways of behaving. Because when you get new ways of behaving, you naturally get new ways of working. Yeah. And so that's what we had to do. Were we always successful? We got a lot of pushback, you know. I mean, especially newspapers, we were replacing page makeup systems, advertising systems, like very traditional, old-fashioned business. So we faced a lot of challenges, but we just kept communicating in different ways. We had to be really good at things like planning, risk management, issue management. And it was tough. It was, you know, when I think back now, I had to hit the ground running, and it's cliche, I know, I had to hit the ground running. I had to learn the entire profession probably in about 4 weeks and then just learn on the job. There was no hiding place. If you got something wrong, you had to hold your hands up straight away. There was an element of vulnerability in order to create connections with people. Empathy was high because we knew that what we were doing was effectively going to change the livelihoods of some people. But most of all, it was about courage and discipline. And really, as a team, finding ways to do things that, you know, we would say, and we'd say they're innovative these days. They weren't back then. It was just about literally, what can we do now to fix this problem? And we would be there till midnight. And no one ever said, we want overtime, we want more pay. No one ever did that because we were so invested in the team and in being successful. And we just love mixing, and, you know, we love socializing and all of the things that great teams do. And so that, you know, it was a great grounding for me because I learned the difference between management and leadership, because I worked for a leader and then latterly I worked for a manager, and I started to see the difference and decided that I would want to be a leader, and then got great at creating teams. You know, we don't teach people how to be great at team building. So I learned how to do that really well too.
Brilliant. So with that, just more personal curiosity, really, because I was involved in some Y2K stuff when I was working at Barclays around the same sort of time. What was your approach with that? Because I'm guessing similarly, mine were more back office services that we were looking at. So there was less absolute criticality on the day-to-day operations that I imagine some of the other things you were talking about there. But there was like chief accountants department and things like that. So they were quite keen for the accounts to be right. How did you approach that? Because I'm guessing you had a setup system and all that that's printing the newspapers, and you can't interrupt the printing of the newspapers on those
days.
Right. They have ridiculously tight deadlines. How did you approach that?
Well, we had to create almost an entirely separate business, and I don't mean with all of the people, but you know, we kind of mirrored day-to-day operations, Nigel, and created something new. You know, we call them environments these days, but we had a completely different environment, because of course what we can't do is interrupt anything with regards to getting the newspaper out.
Yeah, and I suppose the thing, I was going to say, sorry to interrupt, for people who are listening who are young and they may or may not be. The problem was is that the year 2000 thing was that most dates were stored as 99s and then would reset to 01 and wouldn't recognize the fact that it goes to 2000 or 2001. Sorry, moved to 2000, not to 2001. And that was the problem, was making sure that all the services still operated on the day that we ticked over. That's the just contextualize for if I've got some young listeners, which I doubt. But
what I love about that, and I tell this joke all the time on stage, is that people always say, "Oh yeah, it was a red herring, nothing happened." Yeah, because of people like us.
That's a lot of work put in place to stop.
It was us. We saved the world. Everybody's, you're all welcome.
I'm not going to claim that much because I'm not sure I said much. Like
it works well on stage.
Yeah.
So yeah, we had to create a completely separate environment, and in those days as well, Nigel, we were getting four editions out of the newspaper. It wasn't just one.
Oh wow!
It was four editions, and most of them were printed on site. So we had to create a separate environment, and then it was big bang, and so we would switch everything off. So the different days for different sites, we'd switch everything off on a Friday night, and we would redo everything on Saturday. It was so stressful, kind of making sure that everything came back up and everybody's PCs were working. Not only that, and yet the thing that I remember most of all, that was our biggest challenge, was getting the advertising systems to balance.
Nice.
That was the hardest thing of all, to get it to balance exactly to the penny, because that's what the accountants, you know, definitely wanted. So we created a separate environment, and it was full on big bang, and we switched everything off on a Friday, and we switched the new stuff on early hours of Saturday morning.
Some sleepless nights leading up to that.
Yeah, definitely. Well, Sunday morning it was. It was Sunday morning. That's right.
Yeah.
Another great sponsor of the show. He comes in the form of Air Manual. Air Manual is it's a tool for documenting process, which and best practices. It's a company formed by one of my interviewees, Alexis Kingsbury. Essentially, I kind of summarised why my view of where we see documentation, a lot of my experience has been, people will document something, a process, they'll put it in a Visio diagram that gets loaded onto a SharePoint site or something similar. And then a bunch of that. So then once that diagram has been shared with senior management, they're happy they have a process in the business. But then the detailed procedures underneath it might be in Word documents, in just poorly kept and not linked easily and not updated. And what Air Manual does, it allows you to put in it's a tool for doing this kind of thing. You whack it in, the service in there, get in there, put in your process, your flow, and you build it down to as low a level of detail, even to the point of checklists where people can check off they've done it. So it creates that guided checklists, easy to create, easy to maintain, and all in one place. And no one's kind of rooting around to find the SharePoint, and then when you change to new SharePoint services and all that stuff, it's all there. So if you pop along to nigelpreisser.com/airmanual, there's a bit more detail there and a link there to click on to go and get. I think they offer a trial and things like that. So it's something that I think can easily reduce the amount of errors, rework, etc. within our organisation. So, yeah, take a look. Hope you enjoyed that. But you're thinking, ooh, I wonder what the next bit's going to be. Yeah, it's frustrating, isn't it? You heard at the beginning of the show where I said there's a way around that. So if you're really itching and you want to hear the next bit of this show, jump down to Patreon, have a look, find the one that's got a little lock on it, click on it, and you'll be able to get the second half along with the first half all together. And you won't get this annoying bit or the annoying bit at the beginning that I just done as well. So, yeah, give it a go. It's only a price of a coffee. Cheers. I'm sure you enjoyed that. And come back next week and hear the second part. Or, if you want to, run back to episode 9 and fast forward through and listen to the second half yourself. Cheers now. Bye. So this is my final wrap-up. Every week you're going to hear this. You're going to get bored of it, but you can always click next podcast if so. If you have enjoyed it, if you listen to this podcast to the end of this show and you think, that was great, I'd love to be able to help Nige out. There are loads of ways you can do it. The first and obvious way is to share the podcast. Send it out to people. If you know colleagues and friends who'd benefit from it, you think they'd enjoy it, just send them the link. Grab one of the links, send them to www.nigelcreaser.com/podcasts. That's www.nigelcreaser.com/podcasts, and that'll push them over to a Linktree link, and it's got all of the different ways they can consume the podcast. If you are feeling generous and have a big bag of cash, you could grab a copy of one of my books. Obviously, they're available in all the usual places, and print and digital. Again, jump on the website, www.nigelcreaser.com/shop, and that will give you a list of all the different ways that you can contribute and grab copies of the book. Also got links to all my guests' books on there as well, where I get a little bit of a kickback from them. If you are of a sporting mind, I have a number through doing some of my judo and running antics. I've managed to secure a few affiliate links and affiliates there as well. So in there, somewhere in the sponsors page, there's links to those as well. So clicking onto those and grabbing if you're looking to get super fit, then that would be fabulous as well, and I get a little kickback from those. I have a Patreon account. It's patreon.com/sundaylunchpm. So again, you can ping something in there, buy me a coffee or whatever. And finally, obviously the most important is coming back, listen again, because the more of you that come back, the more visibility I get, because there's more times that it's downloaded and all the SEO works and things like that. So yeah, that's it. So if you can help me out, I would be much appreciated. If you can't, don't worry about it. Thank you very much. Cheers now. Bye. My latest the latest affiliate that I've got on the show now is Riverside. I use Riverside to do my interviews, Riverside FM. it kind of offers you a whole, if you like, micro studio management producer tool, and goes beyond that. Has a really good free layer. And I've been using it for a while now. I find it really good. When I've had issues, even though I'm not on one of the higher paid levels, the support has been quick, responsive, and of high quality, and people keen to help me. The organisation seems really good. The product seems really intuitive. Quality is really good as well. And it's a clever way of doing it is when you're recording through your browsers, so you've not got loads of desktop resources being used compared to some other products that I've used. And what they also do is they do they stream a lower quality version of it up onto as you're doing the interview, so you're not burning bandwidth while you're doing the interview and potentially impacting on the quality of the conversation. And then at the end, it uploads it, the higher quality from your browser. It's just a really good way of doing it. So if you are thinking of doing a podcast, know someone's doing a podcast, I would recommend using this tool. I found it really good. Best of the tools that I've tried using to date. And you can get that at nigelcreaser.com/riverside, and that will redirect you to my kickback page on their site, and there I will get a little kickback from them. So take a look. Thanks.
Well, it's goodbye from me, Nigel Creaser, and it's goodbye from him, the Sunday Lunch PM. Goodbye.